Welcome to Fresh Voices. Tonight we're here at Stanford University for the Always On Innovation Summit. Our honored guest is Sandy Berger, who is the National Security Advisor in the Clinton administration, is now chairman of Stone Brick International. Sandy, welcome.
It's great to be with you.
Listen, you know, it's such a beautiful day out here. It's a gorgeous campus. National security isn't the first thing that always comes to mind, but of course, national security is something that needs to be defended without lapse. So the first question is really about one, about how you think about setting priorities. Since in an open society like the United States, targets, the vulnerabilities are nearly unlimited. And since funding for defense against those vulnerabilities would never be perfect, there's always some kind of triage. So how do you think, among all of the different things that can be done, how do you think that we should think about priorities? And are there any differences with the way the current administration is focusing on its priorities?
Well, first of all, after 9/11, national security takes on a new meaning. National security becomes personal security. It's where do I live and where do I work and where are my children and where do I go on vacation? Suddenly, national security is no longer an abstraction. It's become very much a part of people's daily lives, as we saw again tragically last week in London. We have a dedicated group of militants who are intent upon creating death and havoc against the West and particularly the United States. Part of what we have to do is offense. We have to track them down and try to get them before they get us. Part of what we have to do is defense. We have to make the country more secure without trampling our freedoms. I don't think there has really been a strategy over the last 3 years. We've been a lot of money that we've thrown at the problem. We've reorganized the government and formed the Department of Homeland Security. But whenever you reorganize the government, people are more concerned about who do they work for and where's their office and where do they send their kids to to school because they've had to move. And they're not worrying about their job of protecting America. So I think we need to focus on the places where the most people are the most vulnerable. I would start with weapons of mass destruction, that nuclear or biological or chemical weapons getting in the hands of terrorists. And there's a lot more we can do. We're not doing enough with North Korea. We're not doing enough with Iran. We're not doing enough to secure vast stockpiles of nuclear material in the old former Soviet Union and Russia. That would be, for me, number one. We've done a fairly good job at the airports. We've thrown a lot of money at the airports, and you'd have to be a pretty dumb terrorist to try to get on an airplane because there's so many other softer targets. We've neglected mass transportation, as we saw in London. We've neglected protecting our chemical plants and our nuclear plants. I think all of those, and as the final priority I would add, is the shipping and the ports. Only about 5% of the containers that come into the United States are screened, which means 95% of them are not. And any one of those containers could have on it a dirty bomb or some other dangerous weapon.
But it just following up on that, isn't it true that most of our border, our national border, I mean, the Coast Guard does, of course, the job with its water, but, you know, the border with Canada, it's one can freely just move across the border. And
but, you know, we have to embrace technology as part of the solution. So, for example, in shipping, you know, you have barcodes now. You go into Walmart and you buy something. They run the barcode through the little light there, and that tells somebody to order another pair of shoes from Hong Kong because the store in Ashtabula just sold a pair of shoes. So if we can do that with shoes, why can't we do that with cargo? Why can't we inspect those shipments when they depart? And monitor their shipment in a sealed way until they get here in the United States and they're opened up. I mean, I think we've got to be a lot more creative. I think a lot of the solutions are not going to come from government. They're going to come from government stimulating the private sector to develop the kind of technology, whether that's biometric technology or sensing technology, that'll make us safer.
Well, that's a beautiful segue to my next question, because it has to do with the creativity and the thinking about the kind of attacks. There's a trap that's too easy to fall into, which is simply defending against the last attack. Now, that makes sense, because if the attackers have an MO, then it's not sensible to ignore that. But it's not a smart way to. So how do we? The public, through our representatives, are the ones who have to enable funding to be possible. And if something seems unlikely today, aeroplanes as missiles might have seemed unlikely a couple of years ago, turned out not to have been that unlikely. What do we do? How do we not fall into that trap?
Well, we certainly don't want to. We can't build a bubble over the United States. First of all, the bubble wouldn't protect us from indigenous terrorism. And we don't want to live in that kind of society. So there is a balance. But I think there's some places where we know we're vulnerable. I think we have to do a lot more, as I said, on weapons proliferation, weapons of mass destruction proliferation. I think we need to do a lot more on mass transit. We need to do a lot more at our ports and the chemical and nuclear facilities. I would start there. And I think what we haven't had from this administration has been a strategic plan or a set of priorities. And so here we are, 4 years after September 11th, still asking the question of what's most important. We should have resolved this 6 weeks after 9/11. At the time of 9/11, I said I thought America ought to consider 9/11 the way we considered Pearl Harbor. We mobilized this country to go to war after Pearl Harbor, and to build planes, and to build ships, and to build tanks, and Rosie the Riveter, and we were chugging along here. And we have simply not had the same kind of sense of urgency about building a harder, safer America that we had in prior times. Again, I think that's always got to be balanced against, number one, personal liberty and the kind of life that we want to live. We don't want to be implanted with some device that tracks us all. And number two, it's got to be reconciled with the economic efficiency of this society. We can't be so cumbersome that we slow commerce down to the point where people lose their jobs. And that's a balance. And what I haven't seen from this administration is, here's the strategy, here are the priorities, and here are the benchmarks, and we're going to be held accountable for those benchmarks.
Well, let's say it was the Berger administration, the next administration that we're talking about.
That's pretty frightening to think about.
I think I'd vote for you, definitely. My question is, forgetting the military aspects and the normal way we think about defense, but including diplomacy and funding for relieving third world debt and other kinds of what strategy will work so that our grandkids, your grandkids, aren't fighting this when they're old?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I mean, if offense that is going after the bad guys is one part.
Yes.
And defense, which is making this country less vulnerable, is the second part. There's a third leg to this battle, and it's a war of ideas. And it's a question of how America is perceived in the world. We are the most powerful country in the world, economically, militarily, culturally. But power is not the same thing as authority. Authority comes from what we stand for. As a country, it comes from our values. It comes from how we help others. It comes from whether we're a peacemaker in the Middle East or elsewhere. It comes from whether we are seen on the cutting edge of fighting AIDS and the cutting edge of ending poverty, instead of, as we were last week in the G8 summit, being the standing out as saying, no, we're not going to double aid for Africa. That sends a powerful message around the world. And I don't believe terrorism is ever justified by whatever grievance. Terrorism is never justified. But we have to, there's concentric circles. In the inner circle are the people who really are out to get us. We have to be concerned about the second circle, and those are the people who are sympathetic, and we have to be basically trying to isolate the terrorists rather than isolating ourselves.
So in terms of setting gaining the moral authority of the world in the ways that you talked about, does a preemptive military doctrine, does that hurt us or help us? I mean, on the one hand, of course, in an era, in a world from now on, where weapons of mass destruction are simply available and anybody can create with given enough time and resource or can acquire, is a preemptive doctrine where you kill them there before they'll kill us here actually going to succeed, or is it just going to simply generate and spawn far more crazies than we can kill?
Well, let's distinguish between the right of self-defense and a doctrine of preemption.
Yes, that's right.
We always have the right to act before we are, you know, to punch first before we're punched. If we know that we are subject to imminent attack, every nation and every president has preserved the option to strike first. I think the elevation of preemption to a defining strategic doctrine of the United States has been tremendously counterproductive for our country, because Kim Jong-il, for example, in North Korea, who's now building nuclear weapons because we basically won't negotiate with him, you know, he looks at Iraq and he looks at the doctrine of preemption and he says, there's an axis of evil. Iraq was number one. I must be number two. These guys are going to come get me. I'm going to get my nuclear weapons before they come and get me so I have deterrence. So if anything, preemption accelerates the rush towards proliferation and becoming nuclear countries. And second of all, it provides a pretext for other countries to use the same rationale. If we can say we can attack preemptively, why can't India say that about Pakistan or Pakistan say that about India?
Well, not just nation states, but also Al-Qaeda and other kind of informal organizations. Doesn't mutually assured destruction, the policy which kind of kept things from boiling over during the Cold War, doesn't that still work as a vis-a-vis nation states?
It still works against nation states, but it does not work against terrorist groups. In other words, I believe that the chance that North Korea is going to launch a nuclear attack on the United States is virtually nil, because it knows it will be a cinder if that happens.
Yes.
Even Iraq, the notion of Iraq, of course, didn't have weapons of mass destruction, but even if it did have weapons of mass destruction, attacking the United States was zero. But we now have a new phenomenon. We have stateless terror groups, which you can't deter because they don't have an address. And we have not found Osama bin Laden almost 4 years later. We still are looking for them in the mountains of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So there, I think you have, when you have these terror groups and when you're very clear about your evidence that they're individuals that are dedicated, determined to attack the United States, that's the one situation where I think preemption may be justified.
So let me ask you finally to take out your crystal ball for a moment and look into the future. And what, regardless if you're an optimist or a pessimist by your nature, what do you how long do you think we're going to be fighting this war? It seems like decades. Do you see an end to this?
Well, I'm an optimist by nature, but I think we're going to be fighting this war. War may not even be the right word for it. It was a Cold War against the Soviet Union, lasted 50 years. We ultimately prevailed. Soviet Union collapsed. The Berlin Wall came down. But I think that the tide will turn. I mean, I think if we fight on all three fronts, that is offense, defense, and the war of ideas and how we are perceived and what we stand for in the world, then what we really need is for mainstream Muslims around the world, particularly in the Middle East, to stand up and say, no, no more. We don't support you anymore. This is happening, for example, in the Palestinian in Gaza, where finally Palestinians are saying, "We are, you know, the strategy of suicide bombs has been suicide for us. we need, we're not going to end this by ourselves. We're going to end this when it no longer is has a home, and the terrorists become the Muslim communities in which they live become our allies rather than sanctuaries for the terrorists.
Sandy Berger, I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for joining what's probably your first podcast.
It's my pleasure.